Shalom, shalom. Yes, yes. Please, you can start by introducing yourself.
Should I repeat? Okay. So once again, thank you for having us. My name is Strahinja Subotic, Program Manager and Senior Researcher. This is Jelena Miletic, my colleague from, we both work at the European Policy Center, which is a top-ranked think tank in the Western Balkans. And currently we're conducting an advocacy mission to Malta, which is actually a 24th member state that we've been to in person. So we each and every time try to engage with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which we already did in Malta, with the Parliament, doing it now, and with civil society. Here we had a meeting with the SEM Service, European Malta, Maltese European Service. So in that sense, we each and every time discuss enlargement, in particular gradual integration, but we cover issues that are related to democracy, geopolitics, foreign affairs, and the overall idea is to exchange views, to contribute to your policy discussions, to share our thoughts, and maybe to acquire some of your concerns and to try to effectively address all of those. And would you like to briefly introduce our think tank? It was founded.
Thank you. Thank you. As Strahinja said, my name is Jelena Miletic, and I'm basically leading the project structure within our think tank. I'm in charge of preparing, scoping different projects in the areas that we are covering, in basically all EU integration policies. I'm also in charge of business development of the organization. European Policy Center covers four main areas, so to say: public administration reform, which is very broad area, all aspects of public administration reform, but also within this program area we cover good governance, rule of law, even security issues to some point. Our second program area is covering competitiveness and internal market, so economic topics, more or less. The third topic is the so-called green area. So we are, green agenda. We are covering environmental and energy transition topics. And the fourth one, which representative is basically Strahinja within the organization, is Europe, our Europe, where we are trying, at least, but successfully, I would say, to cover different EU policies, familiarize not only the public and the citizens, but also the government stakeholders, businesses, civil society in general with the EU requirements, benefits from the EU integration, and so on. Yeah, it will be briefly that about the European Policy Center. Thank you.
And with that said, I'm glad to see that you have printed out our stage succession model for stage the accession. As such, this is our prime work published in 2021. And the biggest achievement of this model is that it has contributed to the debates that have led the Union to adopt in 2022 European Council conclusions on gradual integration. So ever since then, we were quite happy to see that some of the ideas were transmitted into EU's official thinking, and that was the big turning point, 2022. And subsequently, we had the new growth plan, which incorporated, again, many of the ideas that we came out with, all that stem from the fact we advocated for the necessity of gradual integration, to avoid the fact that prior to these developments, enlargement was binary, That could have made sense during your enlargement or Big Bang enlargement and the ones that followed. But at that time, the enlargement was a relatively short process, accession process, 4 to 6 years on average. And with us, we see Serbia, unfortunately, marking the 10th anniversary of negotiations. Many other countries will negotiate even longer. I mean, Serbia is not doing well these days either. So the overall idea is actually to find a way to incentivize the governments, but also citizens, to show them that despite the end goal being a bit further away from sight, that at least there are some interim steps that will actually allow us to work together. And what better way to do it than with a gradual integration that is supposed to bridge this gap, to build trust, and to give some hope to citizens that the process is predictable, merit-based, and dynamic.
Just one question or a statement which I would like to discuss, because I spoke about it as chairperson even in European Fora with regards to enlargement, not only with regards to the Western Balkans, but more than a general idea. You're saying setting the stage for enlargement and a staged accession to the EU. My impression, and this is my personal opinion, not the opinion of the committee, is that the process is not so predictable. With the ramification that if the process is a bit unreasonably delayed, obviously a country would have a problem in its own to gain support by its own people, because if it's very delayed, obviously the people will start either looking elsewhere or will start to let go, and I mean they will be sort of disappointed about it. In my opinion, I believe that there should be a discussion at a EU level to have a stage accession, as you're saying, and a gradual accession, but a more predictable and structured process, which I believe there are various factors. I'm not imputing anything to someone or to an institution, but my impression is that there is no structured process, and which is not predictable. What do you think about this issue?
I completely agree, and the overall idea of the model is thus to give it some structure, to make it predictable both for the candidates and for member states. And in that sense, we advocated actually for using the existing legal avenues to make this happen, because when we tested the ground, we saw that most member states were not too keen on doing some legal changes, and then we had already the revised methodology. So with our model, we wanted to create something that's implementable in an effective and timely manner. And the way to do it, to address the concerns you rightly mentioned, with which we agree, was the idea to introduce institutional and financial incentives in a merit-based and reversible manner. That's why we introduced two pre-accession stages. We had two pre-accession stages and two post-accession stages. With post-accession stages, we addressed the concerns of skeptical member states when it comes to new veto players. But we can come back to this issue later on. So with institutional participation, when we talk about stages are just a different name, a specific name to mark a point in time from which a country would have gradual increased access to specific incentives. So the institutional incentives, institutionals would inquire or require opening the doors of EU Council, European Parliament, for instance, in a predictable way. We made it predictable with the latest proposal, which says the following. If a country opens a cluster, then it would have this prediction, or it would be predictable, that it would have access to working party level of the council. So this way, Albania has just now opened clusters on single market. It knows that it could count on invitations without voting rights for an occasional exchange of views in the areas corresponding to that open cluster. Yes. And the fact we don't stop there, we say, okay, but if a country closes a chapter, This would actually entail, in terms of predictability, that the country would know it would have the right to participate at co-repair and ministerial levels corresponding to that closed chapter. And we believe that with this institutional tool, you make it predictable because it's in two stages. It doesn't need to be called staged, but it has some sense of graduality, and the fact that the country is closer to membership, the more access to, for example, EU bodies it would have, because we believe that this would be a win-win situation, a good communication tool for citizens, that their voice counts in Brussels, that although we don't have a decision-making power at the moment, we can nonetheless at least share our concerns, and that these concerns could be taken into account. Get information and actually work towards European, not just EU, strategic autonomy. And particularly these geopolitical times, I do believe that socialization that would ensue would be even more important, while adding the fact that this institutional incentive that would be gradual and predictable would incentivize our government to start building its institutional capacities earlier rather than later. Imagine Montenegro with a country with 500,000 people, barely managing as it is to cover business and affairs in Brussels. Imagine the burden they would face upon getting a membership. Malta might have had similar issues. You completely understand it. So to avoid that, we would like to see Montenegro, for example, as the key and genuine frontrunner, being gradually involved, for example, in the work in the Council, while we also discuss other avenues, such as I mentioned, Commission expert groups, comitology, and the European Parliament. But that's not where the story ends. We talk about financial incentives, you rightly mentioned it, and now we have the new growth plan. And as the head of DG Ernest, Hert Jan Koopman, he said that the new growth plan for the Western Balkans is actually a form of staged accession because it increases the carrot, financial carrot, but makes it conditional. So this way, we would embed the process with conditionality, but also predictability, because the country would know that from one stage to another, or from completion of certain reform steps to a higher rate of completion of those steps, they would know that they would be able to count on more funding. And in that case, our recommendation is that there is a necessity to continue discussing the financial incentive besides the institutional one. It is important because the negotiations on the multi-annual financial framework are about to start or have already started. And that's why we came out with a proposal to have the next instrument for enlargement for the Western Balkans, six at least, in the amount of 21 billion euros. And you might wonder, why 21? Well, we estimated that actually the current amount we have, if you account for the grants for the new growth plan and the IPA, the instrument for pre-accession, the overall amount of funding amounts to 40% of the amount we would have as member states. We thus argue that the graduality needs to continue even in the next financial cycle, and that from 40%, we should increase the funding to 60%. And this way, we incentivize, we increase the carrot, but make it fully conditional. Currently, only the new growth plan is conditional. So next instrument, fully conditional, but also increased in total funding. And we believe that what Commission says is correct, that there is a necessity to bridge the socioeconomic gap sooner rather than later. And with these funds, we could potentially do it. With these funds, we can also give more leverage to the EU to condition the reforms. And finally, we can allow the candidates to start building their absorption capacities. Because we heard stories, for example, from Bulgaria, who had pre-accession assistance and then became a member state. The gap was so big that they were unable to absorb all of the funding, and they were actually net contributors in the first couple of years instead of being net recipient. I'm not sure, maybe Malta had the difficulties, I suppose, in the first years of accession, but you can relate to what I'm saying. So in a nutshell, these pre-accession stages or graduality, by introducing these institutional carrots and financial carrots, indeed would be legally based in the existing order, while acting as a game changer that could bring hope to people of the Western Balkans that indeed EU is serious about enlargement, But it could send a good message to Ukraine and Moldova, because although we developed these ideas in the context of the Western Balkans, I can tell you, and I'm going soon to Moldova, that they would, of course, appreciate increased funding while understanding the necessity to have it conditioned, while having also the possibility to gradually have access to more and more EU bodies. So that's in a nutshell how the pre-accession period was envisioned by us.
We were there 20 years ago. So I... We lived the pre-accession period. We lived the frustration, I would say, at times of the people out there who, at some point in time, were thinking, "Listen, are these people taking us for a long journey or a long ride?" And so I think at this very moment, it's very important for Europe to send the message that. I wouldn't bind it with time frames. I would speak about milestones. That if the milestones are achieved, then membership is possible. And I say this more today than probably I would say 20 years ago, because I think Europe is at a crossroad, and the temptations out there to for a number of countries to look elsewhere other than the European Union is a reality. I think that the reality on the ground down there is that there is this movement, anti-EU movement, which is already gaining some ground in member states and potentially in applicant states who have given up or think that that they've been taking for a long ride. So for all, yes, we do understand, because our negotiation process 20 years ago was not an easy process, and at times I think the public sentiment out there could have been that listen, why are we spending so much of our energy on such a route our country should take, when in actual fact. Things were projected to have should have been easier. So we do really appreciate that, you know, that you do need, and the people out there do need a certain sense of certainty as to when membership shall become a reality. Again, I don't think it should be a matter of time frames. I think it should be a matter of milestones. Of statistically, of ticking the boxes in a positive manner, but saying that it's a time frame of 6 years, 5 years, 10 years, I think that's not that would probably give comfort to applicant countries not to to proceed on what has to be done, because time will facilitate the accession process. So I believe that it should be a milestone incentivized process of annexation rather than, you know, a matter of time frames. What I find interesting in this paper we have over here is that you even propose like a two-tier level of membership.
I didn't come to that part.
Yes, tiny Malta, which is as tiny as Montenegro, prides itself, and I think our winning argument out there is that tiny Malta sits around the table with all the bigs in the European Union and has all the rights other European Union members have, which is a big, is a fantastic yes. right, however, a big responsibility. And I must say, and Honorable Zomit Lewis was a minister, and he's aware as well, that catching up with the bigs around the table is not always that simplistic or that easy, because the reality is what it is. This reflects itself even on a parliamentary level, I must admit. We are a parliament where we are not geared, I'd say, till today, 20 years down the line, we are not as yet geared up as much as we should be in terms of analysis, of understanding, of whatever is happening in the European Union in terms of legislation and otherwise. So yes, I agree that there should be some sort of plan as to where negotiations start and where negotiations end. I don't think they should be attached to a time frame, as I said. However, I'd like to listen and hear from you how you foresee it then, after accession, a situation mm-hmm. where you have member states with a lesser, I don't know, a two-tier, I understand, for a period, a two-tier European Union. That would, I'm not sure that would be popular out there, because even locally, I think the winning justification of us acceding to the European Union was actually because once we're there to decide with the rest. And so
we are equal
because now already we had, and if we are out of the European Union, we would still have a situation where whatever happens in the European Union affects us. And now that we are within the European Union, we are around the table to at least have our say in determination.
So I
am not sure that you can say. I need some conviction, some convincing as to how this will give comfort to the people out there that we could have a two-tier European Union once we have become members of the European Union.
No problem. So, indeed, we agreed that the essential principle in the EU is actually the principle of equality between member states, and that we cannot, or you cannot, take any action that would bring harm to this principle. Otherwise, this would reshape the Union not in the way the original treaties envisioned. But at the same time, we recognize the necessity that some candidates or acceding countries might risk being stuck in the process for reasons unrelated to their reform process. That even in case, let's say, Montenegro or other countries might do their reforms, that some skeptical member states might still decide to keep them at bay and block their official accession until EU itself is reformed. Because the oral argument that we have heard, not to name the countries, but you might be familiar with the fact that more and more countries are afraid of new veto players. So that's the argument. So how do we reconcile the principle of equality between member states while finding a solution that would address the concern when it comes to new veto players? And we came out with two proposals. One is more innovative, I would say. And the other one is more conventional, but both are really relevant, I think, particularly now considering that the number of candidate countries is increasing and that the expectations are rising, and that any unfair blockage of a single country who met the reforms would send a damaging effect to all the others in the line, thus weakening the overall promise, but even geopolitical position of the EU. So as for the more original one, and that's the one that we called Stage 3 takes place actually when the country has fully committed or completed all the reforms. So let's say Montenegro completes all the reforms, Commission approves it, member states agree, and they become a member. So in that sense, they would get all the rights and obligations as all the other countries, with exception to veto rights in certain areas. And you might wonder, does this create a second-class membership? Well, we argued that it doesn't for two reasons. First, we would actually limit this temporary derogation to a specific time frame. Temporary derogations have been used before, not in Maltese case, in the case of Malta, but in Poland and other big bank countries, that they had their labor movement limited for 7 years. One could have argued that they were second-class member because they didn't have one of the four fundamental freedoms of the single market. Yet it happened because that was a political necessity. So we believe in this case that by limiting this veto limitation to a period to 7 years, let's say, or maybe 10, maybe 5, it would be a matter of political compromise, is that we can soften the skepticism of some member states that are afraid that newcomers...
And facilitate membership.
Indeed. So Montenegro, in that case, would sign the accession act. Malta, other countries would ratify it. But we would use the very same accession act, which actually has legal power on par with the founding treaties, to adjust the treaties as to allow for, let's say, this country to have its vetoes limited to a seven-year, let's say, period, thus buying the EU more time to continue internally reforming itself while having the newcomer on the inside. And secondly, we avoid second-class membership by the fact that this limitation would automatically expire. So we wouldn't have the possibility of a single member state deciding that the newcomer should forever not have this kind of a say, and this would simply be impossible and incompatible with the founding treaties and would also be very negative in terms of PR and communication with the citizens in the newly acquired member states. So in that sense, we had many skepticism at first when we proposed this stage three, as we called it, and stage four being a stage in which the country would actually get its veto right after, let's say, 7 or 10 years.
And sunset clause.
Yes.
And you believe on the ground there's appetite for this?
So at first, zero appetite. But when the war started, I can tell you now, and we've been to 24 member states, that's the first thing they ask about. Most or many countries ask about it. It doesn't need to be universally applied veto limitation, but some sort of original decision-making limitation that would, of course, require consent of the candidate is, and I can reassure you, deeply under assessment in many member states and, not to name names, but in some relevant bodies in Brussels. And this is considered both in the case of the Western Balkans but also in the Eastern trio. And I can tell you the information that is already public. For example, the previous government of Macedonia stated in many discussions and public debates that if it takes for, let's say, North Macedonia to renounce its veto rights for a certain period of time, but instead getting all the other things that currently seem completely out of reach, then that's something they would more than be ready to accept if that's what it takes for them to become a future member state. I had another meeting among the Eastern Trio partners, not to mention names, but one of the highest officials brought this issue on their own, arguing that indeed EU membership is something that's a lifelong dream and goal of that country, and that if it takes for this, you know, to be limited, then so be it. So that's one of the ways how we foresee thus future members to progress when it comes to enlarging the union. But of course, it requires communication. It requires early on, and that's why we insist. That's why we come to Malta and other countries to just break some concerns, break some mists of doubts that had existed before, just to clarify how it would completely work in practice. And as one of the member states, very important member states, argued, that in case all member states agree politically to make this happen, and as a last political compromise, the candidate approves this measure, then politically they would be creating a legal precedence that would be applicable to other candidates as well.
What I wish to add is, this makes sense, the last point you made, because I believe that membership, 2 points, time is of essence now with regards to what happened in Ukraine. And secondly, the political criteria. I mean, membership became more political than economic or than to the adherence of the acquis communautaire, of the rules. So the priority it is, we must admit that it is highly political. So this will grant the flexibility. I'm not diminishing what my colleague said, because obviously the integration is that everyone should be on the same plane, everyone should be equal, and everyone should be on the same table. But I believe that a lot of aspiring states, and even the EU on the other hand, are in a panic mode to a certain extent, that they believe that a large union will help as well with regards to reinforcing the security architecture of Europe. The second point, and I'm seeing a paper which is very important. I believe that a successful union cannot be successful without bridging the social disparities. And this takes us to the emergence of the strength of the far right with regards to immigration, to social disparities, and I believe that it should be the main thrust of the union to bridge these social inequalities within the union. That's all from my part.
I couldn't agree more, and if some member states were also afraid that enlargement would be costly, that it would actually feed the Eurosceptics in their country, we had analysis which has shown that actually the cost, if we imagine big bank or mini bank to the Western Balkans, would be 0.02 of their GNI, which is actually per capita annually 5.8 euros, which is less than 2 cups of coffee per EU citizen, to accommodate, particularly from this financial perspective, enlargement in that case. Not to mention that, for example, Malta would be able to further benefit from tourism. You have already a lot of Serbs. You can only imagine how they would continue traveling here. And not to mention that from a non-monetary perspective from a security perspective, Western Balkans can play an important role to really address this geopolitical time of
their concern
crisis.
And the union's concern.
Yeah.
So it's a bit
so there will be long-term returns
benefit.
Oh, in any investment in the region. I do believe that this can bring long-term return to the EU and its member states as well, while help us drive out other external actors such as Russia, or maybe China, which have not always had intentions or projects that were in line with EU's rule of law and public procurement standards. And just to forget one more thing, if you don't mind me jumping back to the post-accession limitations. We talked about veto limitations, which could be considered as a novel, maybe even radical proposal. But another proposal about which I'm currently writing a paper, and I'll publish a paper next month about it, is the one that focuses on safeguard clauses. I say it's conventional because, although it's unknown, basically, to most stakeholders I have engaged with, safeguard clauses already exist in the acts of Croatia, Bulgaria, and Romania. I'm not sure if Malta had those, but for Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria, I'm 100% sure. So their accession act introduced for the first time. So politically, they decided to agree. They introduced something that was not existing before, internal market safeguard clause, so applicable to four freedoms. So very
wide number of
chapters, yes. And another one, which is not as extensive, but still super relevant, justice and home affairs. And the safeguard clauses say that there is a backsliding in those areas, the Commission or a single member state can activate this clause to suspend certain provisions that apply to the areas that I mentioned, single market and justice and home affairs. The catch is that EU could have applied to those clauses within 3 years upon accession. So our proposal is that you should consider extending the duration, maybe, again, 7 or 10 years, during which you can apply the safeguard clauses in case there is a backsliding in the newcomer. And secondly, you should consider extending the number of safeguard clauses so that the rule of law...
There is a court precedent as well with the case of Commission against Hungary, when Hungary tried to attack the question of EU funds with regards to the rule of law conditions, the conditionality, and obviously Hungary lost the case, so there is a case law that allows this conditionality for excess of funds and other things that may be available.
I'll make sure I put that in my paper. Thank you for the suggestion.
Because that is a
because it completely
case,
makes sense.
I believe it's 2 years ago.
Yes. So, yes, now you have the overview of pre-accession benefits that we talked about, or incentives, and post-accession limitations to address the member states' concerns, thus making this package a unique exercise that really looks long-term and short-term at the same time. And this was created by us and another partner from Brussels, actually. So we always had this two-way perspective.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for these papers. I'm sure that I will take a great look at them, because it's a very interesting subject. And very interesting subject, and it's dynamic in the sense that things are changing with the situation in Ukraine. Obviously, some things changed a lot, and there was a shift in priorities as well. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
It was enjoyable being in Malta.
And you're enjoying in Malta? It's your first time in Malta?
This is the first time, definitely, and we are enjoying.
Certainly not the last. We look forward to being back. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The second is reminding me of the formalities for the
نرفيري نرفيري على عنمرو 24 داتا 19 تاميو تسانا كورنتي li għaw il-minuti u jekk mawx oppożizzjoni minnaħa tal-membri tal-kumitat noqgħod għali il-minuti huma mgħoddija. Fil-kwarta u xek?
Fil-kwarta u dak edha infilzjata biex laqgħa toħra xek. Forsi tibgħat email din hija laqgħa jien naf int jagħmel laqgħa l-ispeaker mhux laqgħa ma' xi kumitat ieħor. Le, mhux triq, però l-laqgħa tagħna hija pereżempju qabilna mill-speaker.
Massumi għax dawk jagħmluhom.